Welcome to episode 57 of the Champagne Comedy Podcast, where we talk about the best Australian comedy show from the 90s ever made, Frontline, and other degeneration comedy tidbits. My name is Matt, and joining this podcast today is Alison, Daniel, and Kim.
Hey!
Hey!
How are we all?
Yeah, pretty well.
Excellent. Good, good, good. Good to hear.
Well, I noticed that there's someone who's in a new location to record this today, which is kind of appropriate given the title sequence of this episode. But we'll get to that.
Yeah, fair enough.
No, I'm in the same old recording spot myself, with some sort of karaoke party happening. Hopefully, not bleeding into the background, but they were butchering Bohemian Rhapsody before, so. If I start singing along, you'll tell me, right?
Well, go over there and start. Ask them to put on something that would be the end of the late show, like a musical mashup, or
I think,
or maybe your mashup of the Frontline theme and Working Class
no.
Man.
No. So, Alison, you're the one who's hunky dory.
unless the bus goes past, that they can sometimes be quite loud. But yeah, I'm thinking that Daniel's neighbor's party, I think, should do a few sort of 1995 bangers, maybe a bit of Out There Brothers, a bit of Simply Red. You know, there's some amazing music happening. Let's hear it, guys.
I have some listener feedback, and it's in regards to the last couple of episodes of this season and a little bit of last season as well. Regular contributor to the podcast, Peter Phoebe, who has been awesome and sent through a couple of articles of Frontline, which we've been posting on our social media accounts on Champagne Comedy. He has written here, "I've been catching up on the last 3 to 4 shows over the last week." He tends to give the episodes a rewatch as he's listening. So top stuff. That's what this podcast is about. And in season 1 episode review of Frontline, someone was talking about stew and apple pie references. And I think that might've been Prue who mentioned that, going by memory.
What was the reference? I can't remember.
Oh, it's just more or less the, hey, anyone want to go for an apple pie? Or it's just a Macca's apple pie.
Right.
I do remember a couple of scenes where
Stu always seems to want one.
In episode 1 of season 2 of Frontline, Stu references wanting to get some apple pie just after a team meeting as he and Jace has had to rush out the door to do some work, which is about 6 minutes into the episode. Anyway, continue to do the fine work that you guys are doing. So thank you very much, Peter. And yes, I do remember that apple pie reference in that episode. And well, let's just say because Prue wasn't on board, we didn't get to call it out.
We have a nice character note for Stu, though. He's a bit obsessed with that molten lava apple filling.
Burn the roof of your mouth.
Yeah. Some people like chili. Some people want their mouths burnt.
But yeah, it's true. We should have kept a counter of these things. Considering how fastidious we've been looking at for appearances of everybody's favourite photocopier repairman. I was about to say Kevin Conacher, but that's not his name. Damn it.
Colin.
But then again.
Shoot.
Well, there's plenty for Conacher fans this episode.
Oh, I don't know. It was copier overload for me.
There's a very easy find in this episode.
We'll set the toner for that.
Nah.
Okay, so a few weeks ago, 7 West Media, the company that owns Channel 7, as well as the West Australian newspaper, have launched a nightly digital newspaper called, funnily enough, The Nightly. And sort of if you've had a look at any of the issues, you might sort of notice sort of where they're coming from, because there's a lot of ads for Channel 7 and Sunrise and 7 Plus and a lot of mining advertisements as well. So, you know, you see Woodside and BHP and another sort of industry one saying how good the mining industry is for jobs. despite it being absolutely fucked for everything else, to be honest.
They're quite sitting on the fence, are they?
Well, it doesn't seem like it. There's word that the Nightly has been set up to sort of have a bit of political influence in the East, as the West Australian does in the West. One thing I like very much about the Nightly is the culture section, which is edited by Wenli Ma, film reviewer. She used to be on news.com.au, and I quite liked her reviews there. Second only, of course, to Champagne Comedy Podcast's very own Tony. In the first week of the Nightly's existence, she went through a top 50 list of Australian actors, and for the second week she did the top 50 Australian movies. And it turns out that one of the movies in that top 50 is The Castle.
Is any questions for Ben in there?
Yeah. Sadly not.
How about The Dish? I mean, The Dish was actually quite good.
That came in at number 51.
That missed out too. I thought we might make a bit of a game of these things, and just considering, I don't suppose any of you read The Nightly, did you?
Nope.
Okay.
No, I think I saw a link to it somewhere, but I clicked on it once and saw all those mining ads and didn't read the content.
or seeing all those not so subtle news stories about it on 7 News. I'm going to ask each of you where you reckon it ranked in the top 50. I might start with you, Kim.
Number 7.
You reckon it was number 7?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just writing your name into the, just so I've got you down for number 7. Alison, where do you reckon it ranked?
Number 2.
Oh, that's quite high.
Hmm.
Okay, and Matt, where do you reckon it ranked?
I was going to say number 2, but because you already got first dibs on it, I'll say number 3. And I am sure that at least Crocodile Dundee will be either 2 or 1. That's why they're pushing The Castle down to, say, number 3.
Kim, at number 7, we had Gallipoli. Now, Alison, at number 2, we had Breaker Morant.
Breaker Morant's a very good film.
And, Matt, your number 3 was Animal Kingdom.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
Okay. So with that out of the way, I can tell you that The Castle ranked number 14 on the list.
Ooh.
Wow.
Baffling.
Exactly, baffling.
Yeah.
So, okay, what's in the top 10?
Going from 10 to 1. So number 10 is 1979's My Brilliant Career. Number 9 is Muriel's Wedding. Number 8, Looking for Ella Brandy. Number 7, Gallipoli. Number 6, Mad Max Fury Road. Then number 5, Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Yep, that's a good movie.
Yep, number 4, Lantana. Then Animal Kingdom at number 3, Breaker Morant at number 2. And number 1, I'm not quite sure if you would call it a cult thriller.
I was going to say, is it Housemaid Horror?
Wake in Fright? Is it Wake in Fright?
Yeah, it's Wake in Fright.
Wake in Fright's a very good film
is
as
that,
well.
Is it a popular movie, though?
It's a cult sort of thing, isn't it, Wake in Fright?
It seemed to sort of, I would say, sort of come out of existence and then sort of come back in again with the video and DVD revolution, I reckon.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of it until the DVD came out.
Yeah, when I watched it for the first time, I went in guns a-blazing thinking, oh, it's going to be like the Castle-esque type thing. No, it's more of a children's movie.
If your children are really messed up, it is, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty messed up watching it as an adult, I would say, but anyway.
So I'll read Wenli Ma's synopsis of The Castle, ranking at number 14. From the pool room to tell him he's dreaming, The Castle was such a cultural phenomenon. The Australian film industry spent years trying to recapture lightning in a bottle by aping Rob Sitch's movie in tone and theme. The story of the Kerrigans fighting against the compulsory acquisition of their home is a classic David versus Goliath battle, repackaged in a tale that taps into the Australian dream of the suburban quarter-acre block and being the master of your own domain. Increasingly a wish fulfillment fantasy in 2024, The Castle's fighting spirit lives on in all optimists. And she notes that you can watch the movie on Stan, which is also where you can find Frontline.
That list is interesting. These kind of lists are always, they publish them to cause debate and, you know, get people talking and stuff, yeah. Right? But it's interesting that all of those top 10 ones are dramas. You know, there's always in these kind of lists a bit of a snobbery towards comedy, which is why The Castle, which really, in my opinion, should be in that top 10 and quite up in that top 10, is like number 14. It's because it's a comedy and there's often a prejudice against comedy.
Yeah, I must say that there's more comedies sort of down the bottom of the list. So, yeah, just working out what the comedies are is a bit of a thing in itself. So, yeah, Muriel's Wedding is sort of the highest comedy there at number 9, I'd say.
Yeah, but it's sort of feel good as well.
Did any questions for Ben outrank Wog Boy 2, The Kings of Mykonos?
Neither of those made the top 50. Some other comedies in the list. So we had Priscilla, Queen of the Desert at number 21. Love and Other Catastrophes at number 36. Kenny at 37. Mary and Max at number 40. I think that might be more on the drama side of things.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's got Barry Humphries in it, but it's more of a drama. Yeah.
What about Guru Wayne?
Meat Pie, where's that?
Yeah. I'm not sure. Is Snowtown a comedy?
No?
Okay.
The bit where they put kangaroo bits in a bucket definitely isn't.
Scumbus?
Oh, well, that was at number 35, oh, Snowtown, anyway.
No bad eggs, I assume.
Number 43? We didn't have anything else from Working Dog alumni in the top 50, but sort of rounding it out, the Big Steal at number 43, The Sapphires at number 45, and Crocodile Dundee scraped in at number 50.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, yeah, pretty drama heavy, I would say. But, yeah, you can read it all in the nightly, just scroll past the Catalyst ads for mining magnates and Harvey Norman.
Honestly, if Boytown was in there,
you'd be surprised.
Yeah, I think. Well, thank you very much for that, Daniel. I really appreciate some movie madness when our regular film critic is not on board in the episode.
Yeah, sorry, Tony. I'm not trying to white ant you, I swear.
I feel like we need a musical intro for Daniel. Oh, sorry, I've just talked over that. We have Oh Jesus, but
yeah, I think it's time to upgrade the that grab bit. So maybe I can turn it into a remix or something like that. Stay tuned in a future episode, okay? So we'll do an upbeat of
Oh Jesus,
Daniel Genie's program guide intro.
Oh, shit, it's me again. Okay. Good for everybody who is sick of me, I know.
You bring the
rapier.
Been a while.
I was going to say we're front-loading this episode with the good stuff. You know, it's not us crapping on. It's all that rock-solid good Daniel G stuff.
Oh, thanks.
Right at the front. And then you don't have to listen to the rest of the episode. Right?
Yeah, as soon as I hear the jingle.
I hope you do, you know, make it all the way through. Mm. So, let's get on with it. There's a few distractions in the rest of the program guide. For a start, there was a piece about Frontline in the Sydney Morning Herald guide from Andrew Conway, who mentions that wags at the ABC's 7:30 report have pinched a large Frontline logo made for last year's end-of-series wrap party at the Gore Hill Bunker and placed it at the entrance to their own office. People visiting the 7:30 report office now step out of the lift on the third floor to find a large banner for the make-believe current affairs show. I went to see Andrew Olley and nearly asked for Mike Moore, said one visitor.
Said one visitor that I made up.
Quite possibly. There was also an interview with Kevin J. Wilson, who plays the new EP, Sam. I was more interested in the little breakout box titled Murphy's Law, where executive producer Sam Murphy talks about the rest of the Frontline team. So about host Mike Moore, quote, "His great talent is that he can take a subtle hint and make it his own idea. He's a good ideas man. At least we make them his own and clarify them for him. He's also a man of the people. We don't want anyone up there who's a wild card." About reporter Brooke Vandenberg, he says, "I've only one thing to say about Brooke. She's got the best legs in current affairs. She can open doors which are closed for the rest of us. A little black book is quite valuable. She has an enormous range of contacts, especially in the pop world. She's a flashier version of Yana Vent. I think she's better, more commercial." about reporter Martin D'Estasio, who says, an EP's dream. He's going to get the story even if there isn't one. I don't want to know how he gets it, and I don't care. As long as he comes back with the story, I take his word for it. Then we hear his thoughts about producer Emma Ward. Emma frustrates me a little with her honesty and morals. She'd make a great nun, but she's very hardworking. I hate it when she's out of the office because the whole place falls apart. Everybody loves Emma. If she has a fault, she's too nice for TV. Then, talking about publicist Jan Whelan, we link minds, Jan and I. We don't have to talk. We just sort of look at each other and know exactly what we want. She's a sharp operator, knows how to get the job done. Typical Australian publicity woman. And finally, and most shortly, about funny man Elliot Rhodes. We wanted John Clarke, but we couldn't afford him.
Yeah.
Oh.
So there we go. Quite a bit of insight into our new EP. But I would say the most distracting thing I found in the program guides was the cover story on the Age Green Guide. I'll read the intro. After the demise of the D-Generation, Tony Martin and Mick Molloy have regenerated as national radio stars, writes Richard Yallop. The headline, and this is really going to make you cringe, M&M Radio Smarties.
Oh, dear.
They're mixing their palms up.
Is that better or worse than my favourite Martin?
They're both, I mean, if there was a top 10 of those, we'd be struggling to sort of put them in a sensible order. Yeah, that's a good reaction.
I give that a zero. Yeah.
So I'll read a bit of the intro here. The weekend after The Late Show finished on ABC television in October 1993, the D-Generation gathered at a house in Tookaroook to discuss their future. Rob Sitch, Tom Gleisner, Santo Chilaro and Jane Kennedy went one way to Frontline, their parody of television current affairs, and Tony Martin and Mick Molloy went on a comedy tour of Australia, which ended up in a drive-time double act in the Melbourne studios of Fox FM. Yeah, the show hasn't been going for too long. It started in about April, but already it's rating quite well around Australia.
Can I just squeeze in to cut off your little program guide a bit, because it's in topic to your program guide, talking about Martin Molloy, and this is also, I guess, part of Backchat too. Now they've fully released it on their website, the National Film and Sound Archive, celebrating 100 years of radio, and there's a nice dedicated page to Martin Molloy where there's a bunch of little clips and pieces from Tony's collection that he donated. So you can check that out. There's always been stuff there.
That big stash of tapes that he kept.
Yeah, so there's always been something available as part of their curation on their site, but because of the 100 radio display, there's a lot more on there. So check it out.
The only other thing I want to highlight from the article is a couple of quotes from Dave Taranto, the Melbourne comedy broadcaster, as he's called here in the article. So this is him talking about Tony Martin. He understands the power of every word and the rhythm of the language, and he'll really labour on something until it's perfect. He has a total understanding of comedy and knows exactly how it works.
Yep. No arguments there.
And then he talks about Mick. Mick is the bloke, the larrikin, who just goes out and does it, while Tony is the wordsmith. Tony could get by with one-tenth of the effort because he's so good, but he has to put in 110%. The common thread is their fascination with popular culture and things like tacky TV ads. The last part of the interview has Tony Martin asking what might have happened to the interview if Martin Molloy had not won its time slot, asking where will it go if we're a ratings flop? The odd spot? So... not much of a punchline, really.
Not at all.
All right, let's get to the program guide proper. So after Frontline, Four Corners and Media Watch on the ABC, we have Absolutely Fabulous. Season 3, Episode 3, originally aired back in April this year, 95, and it's titled Sex. Patsy convinces Adina to hire two male prostitutes for an orgy on the night of Saffron's university presentation, as you do. Patsy attempts to enliven the mood by playing a video of an orgy she and Eddie attended in their youth, only to find that it has been accidentally switched with a tape of Safi's school project.
Yeah.
Over on Channel 7, we've got Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman. And it's season 2, episode 21, titled Wine, Wine, Wine. And this aired back in May. Superman is forced to get a lawyer when someone he saves sues him for damages incurred during the rescue. Now, I think there might already be a legal precedent here up against Mr. Incredible. There's also a subplot where Bill Church Jr., played by Bruce Campbell, is out of jail again. The other thing is that these episodes are sort of being aired out of order.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Because
there was a Christmas episode last week.
Was that a very common thing to do in those days, just to randomly play whatever they had they well, got their hands on?
That's what Channel 10 did with Simpsons. It was they'll be playing a season and then suddenly there'll be like two episodes missing or whatever, but you don't know it until afterwards. And they did that with, I think, they did a special with Raiders of the Lost Bart, they called it, and they had the, what's his name, Jed and Ryan from Cheese TV host it. And it was called The Simpsons Lost Episodes. And it's like, you didn't listen, you just chose not to play it, that's all. And because it was, I think it was heavily censored.
I reckon part of it could have also been just trying to work out, you know, like...
Australian content?
It might have been to do with ratings and classifications.
Don't back Channel 10.
Now, over on SBS, we actually have a bit of a reprieve from The Defenders of the Wild.
Ah,
because this week on SBS is a week of themed program called About Television. Funnily enough, About Television. Peter Weiniger wrote about it in The Green Guide, saying the 29 programs are not set up to provide answers, but to ask questions, raise the issues that most concern us, and if possible, lift awareness about television so we may become better informed consumers. So I dare say, if you're a fan of Frontline, you probably would have found a program or two on SBS for you. And the one that's up against Frontline is called LA Stringers. So it's an American documentary capturing the working life of a group of cameramen as they film the violent exploits of street gangs, drug dealers, and prostitutes in Los Angeles.
So it's an episode of Cops.
Yeah, pretty much. And really, this sort of job, really, it's been taken down now that everybody's got a camera in their pocket. You know, like this sort of thing you see on, you know, TikTok and Worldstar all the time.
You watch A Current Affair or something and a lot of it seems to be based on mobile phone footage, so that's definitely true.
Yeah, no stringers allowed. They just have to go trolling on TikTok and Reddit and all that sort of thing. Yeah. Over on Channel 9 at 7:30, we've got Hope and Gloria, the American drama series about a woman who works for an egotistical Pittsburgh talk show host. Now, I haven't been able to find much at all about this show, apart from that I don't think I even mentioned last week what the title was. Last week's debut episode was titled Are We Having Fun Yet?
Is the answer no?
Well, I think we've heard that line in Frontline. It's a very difficult thing asking a question. Let alone whether it's in the title of a show or on a billboard.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing if Hope and Gloria is on next episode.
Yeah.
Or whether it's kind of lasted two episodes. Yeah, how long will it last?
Spoiler alert, there are a few more weeks left.
Okay.
So, this is season 1, episode 2, and it's titled No Degrees of Separation, and That's All I Know. Then at 8 o'clock, we've got Frasier, season 2, episode 6, titled The Botched Language of Cranes. When Frasier makes a disparaging remark about Seattle's weather, he offends his listeners. And his attempt to remedy the situation by speaking at a charity dinner only makes things worse. And finally on Channel 10, we've got Healthy, Wealthy and Wise. And the first thing that it's got here on the listing is that it features a look at doll collecting.
Ooh.
Dare I say it, Jane Kennedy would love that segment, I reckon.
She maybe doesn't have the kind of nice dolls that I assume are in this segment. It was all lovely porcelain antique dolls. She would have like creepy plasticky 70s ones.
Or not no basic instinct doll.
And I mean, who knows? Maybe Tommy G might like the segment as well. If you don't know what I'm talking about there, look up Have You Been Paying Attention, Barbie Hughes. Hilarious segment from last year.
Were they putting Barbie dolls on a barbecue? What were they doing?
No, it was Barbie Qs, as in questions.
Oh, okay, right.
So it was all about, he was bringing out all these different kinds of Barbies that would do different things and asking the panelists, what do they do?
Alison, it was a play on words.
Okay, right, got it.
Think about that.
I would like them to do barbecues on that new Barbie that features Queen Camilla, because I'd love to know what she does.
Yeah,
I'm afraid I don't know about that.
There must be a UK thing. You can look this up. There is a Barbie doll that got released recently, and it's a Queen Camilla Barbie doll. And there's a photo of Queen Camilla holding the Barbie doll that looks like her. And if you've ever, wanted a Camilla doll, now's your opportunity.
Yeah. Comes with its own stable, turtles, some hay.
We assume so, yeah.
Now also we've got a recipe for beef goulash, a trip to New Zealand, how to give your crockery and tiles a lift, and property values around the country. Again, to quote Wenli Ma, increasingly a wish fulfillment fantasy in 2024.
Yeah, the property values would have been amazing in 1995. You know, they would have actually been affordable for the average person, I suspect.
Yeah. So while we think about that, I've been talking far too much, so let's get on with the actual episode.
Thank you very much, Daniel. Appreciate the time and effort that you've put into your bits and pieces.
Thanks.
No worries. All right, Kim, it's your go. So get your golden tonsils ready.
I'm glad you're doing it, Kim, because my voice is buggered at the moment.
Kim will do the program guide next week. All right. 4, 3, 2, cue in.
Hello, I'm Kim. This is Frontline Season 2, Episode 4, Office Mole, broadcast Monday, August 14, 1995.
Yay!
Yay! Yay!
And the synopsis for this episode, Office Mole, is Mike is bored. But when Frontline suspects that someone is leaking stories to another station, he springs into action. Now, before we go into it, did anyone notice a bit of a refresher from the intro of Frontline of this episode?
Yes. Yeah, this is what I was referring to earlier about your different background today, Matt.
I'm actually broadcasting from my kitchen. So,
yes. Yeah. Well, Mike Moore, when he in the title sequence where he says, "Hello, I'm Mike Moore, welcome to Frontline," he's actually on the new set. And we sort of saw the new set briefly in the previous episode. But, yeah, he's there on the new set and it's blue.
Yes, it is. It's blue. And you look at his hair, it's a little bit more tighter. It's not as fluffy. Still parting on the same side, but...
Must be all that pert.
So with this, with the office mole, everyone is busy in the office doing their own thing, with Mike bored shitless, like really bored shitless. He's just walking around the office. Everyone's doing their own thing.
Yeah, like kind of ignoring him a bit.
Yeah.
He looks kind of like, he feels a bit hapless. He doesn't know what's going on. But yes, bored is probably a more appropriate word.
In his office, though, Mike is reading the 40-hour famine pamphlet. Now, this starts something, doesn't it? So remember that, the 40-hour famine? Is that still going?
Yeah, I remember not wanting to do it because I wanted to eat.
Here's a little jingle from 1995.
Babies crying, children dying, it's not the way the world should be.
For 40 hours and help save a child. Join the World Vision 40-hour famine now. Call 13 22 40.
Come on, zip your lip.
Zip your lip. Now, as you heard that, out of context, that just sounds so disgusting with the zip.
Yeah, I was like, I thought you were putting fart sounds in the background for a second.
I think it reads slightly differently in 2024. I think... People were, I guess, less familiar with some of your more niche kinks, maybe in the 90s.
Martin Malloy had only been on for a few months at this point.
Yeah, exactly. They hadn't got round to all the niche kinks at that point, and certainly the internet hadn't informed us of it. I remember the 40-hour famine. I remember at school you could do one that was like designed for kids to participate in it, but it only went for like 10 hours or something. But the other thing about 40-hour famine that I remember, which was kind of cheating maybe, is that you were allowed to have water, obviously, but you were also allowed to have a few butter menthols or something.
Barley sugars.
Barley sugars,
Now, the thing is, I never participated in a 40-hour famine, but even I can remember it was water and barley sugars was the only thing you could have. I suppose because they didn't want to have any sort of liabilities on their hands.
Well, barley sugars were for the glucose, your blood sugar level.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I remember participating that once. I think you had the 40-hour famine, and then there was when you're a teenager or whatever, it might have been made up from my school, but there was a 12-hour famine and the 8-hour famine. And
no, it was an official one, the shorter version for kids to do it.
I remember the 8-hour famine because I wanted to do that, and I was told not to. I'm going, but what about the starving children?
Stuff them. Well, I assume that was the reaction of your parents or teachers. Screw them.
I donated my chore money. So even though I couldn't do the 8-hour thing.
Good on you, Matt.
Yeah. I didn't last long, though. Like after 4 hours, I was hungry. Especially when Dad had ordered chicken and chips for lunch.
That's really unfair.
Oh, it was.
Was he like waving it in front of you, going, "Oh, look at what I've got"?
Yeah, he bought a pineapple fritter, which is my favourite, and it was like,
what?
It was coated deliciously in the cinnamon sugar, and it was a thick batter one, and it was so the smell was so good. I went, I broke it. I couldn't resist the pineapple fritter.
Who can?
Well, in 1995, it was called the 40-hour famine. Nowadays, we just call it intermittent fasting.
Or the cost of living crisis.
Okay. Actually, the 40-hour famine is still going. I've just done a quick lookup. It happened on the weekend of the 25th to the 27th of August, 2023. So I dare say it'll roll around again this August as well.
I might do that. I need to lose some weight.
Yeah, do we try and set ourselves this challenge?
Yeah, well, no.
Try and hold a podcast recording on 40-hour famine weekend this year. And I mean, it's a good thing we're doing this remotely because if we were in the same room, we would probably be, I don't know, scratching each other's eyes out for a barley sugar or something.
Yeah, it'd get a bit Lord of the Flies if we did that. It's a good thing we live in different parts of the world.
As Mike is snacking away after the pamphlet, Dom walks in.
Mike, guess what?
He's called.
Who?
Glenn Ridge.
No, ratings, 28.
Great. So he hasn't answered any of my calls?
No, don't worry about it, Mike.
So rude of him.
Call, don't worry about it. The ratings, Emma says this is the 10th night in the row we've beat the others.
Sick of chasing, that's it.
And, you're in the paper today.
He's let me down.
Do you want me to cut it out for your book?
What's it about?
Are you doing the 40-hour famine?
Oh, no, don't worry about it.
Yeah, Mike's distracted by trying to get in contact with Glenn Ridge, which is bizarre since he was at the party, Mike's party.
Yeah, I dare say this is where Mike might have tried to bring up the proposal of what Mike wants to do on Sale of the Century.
Yeah, it's the Battle of the Current Affairs show host, isn't it? He mentioned this in the first series.
Yeah.
And I suspect that Glenn Ridge is ghosting him about this idea, either that or Jan's trying to put a spike in it, because I remember the plot in series one was that Jan didn't want him to do it because it would reveal that he was a bit sick.
Dom checks in on Shelley to see if anyone knows what exactly.
Ooh, what does she know?
Mike keeps trying to call Glenn Ridge via Channel 9 offices with little success.
Glenn Ridge, please.
Hold the line. Sale of the Century.
Glenn Ridge, please.
Who's speaking?
Mike Moore.
He's not in. Can I leave a message?
He's not in all that often, is he?
Can I leave a message for him?
Yeah, he's got my number. Tell him he can call me any time, at home, work, any time. I mean, it's not urgent.
I'll pass that on.
Yeah, sure you will. Assholes.
Thank you for calling.
The perils of speakerphone.
In the kitchen, we have Emma passing on the message of good ratings news to Sam, while Marty is snacking away. He's also meant to be on the 40-hour famine.
Yeah, he's got a packet of Twisties on the go.
I just love the fact that he is not participating, but he's supporting it.
Mm-hmm.
That's just like a, was that you, Matt? But that wasn't my, but yeah, that wasn't,
I mean,
my
sure, I mean,
choice.
I
just weren't allowed to.
Yeah, I don't know too much about the rules, but would there have been like a financial penalty if you had to break the rules, or?
Oh, no, if you broke the rules, that's it. You just get disqualified.
What, and World Vision doesn't get any money?
Oh, actually, I don't
Haven't
know.
Haven't there been people who've accidentally, like, not, they thought that after 39 hours they'd finished it or something, and I've heard about these people and they only collect the money for 39 hours or whatever. I don't know. It's up to you. No one's, like, policing this. Collect the money anyway and give it to the starving kiddies.
I reckon that might have been the plot line of, I'm pretty sure there was an episode of Colin Carpenter that was centred around the 40-hour famine.
Yeah, that's probably what I'm thinking of.
So maybe it did, the whole 39 hours only happened in Colin Carpenter.
Everyone else did it perfectly apart from Colin.
Yeah. I do think when I did break it, though, it was, we still got the money, but it's like, you're going to have a guilt trip afterwards because you're taking money.
Is this 40-hour famine or is this Lent? Like basically, Lent is the 40-hour famine without the fundraising. Although, mind you, you know, it's just about not eating meat on Fridays. But speaking as a very busy Catholic, I've got to say. I've got to say, like Fridays at this time of year just really shit me. And I know I could.
Come on, man!
I know I could just eat meat on a Friday and just, you know, like say I didn't. But you know, he'd be pretty angry.
Well, how are you supposed to honour? You're supposed to honour Jesus' sacrifice or whatever. I don't know. I'm an atheist. I don't really know what you're doing. But
you know what? Talking about that, Remember, like, because my family is not deeply religious or anything. If anything, my nana or whatever was Church of England. So if we had to relate to some type of religion, it was Church of England. But as I grew older, I'm atheist as well. And it was like Fridays, well, Good Friday was always great because it helped with Dad. Dad loves cooking. And it's like his excuse to cook fish. And every time he cooked, he turned it into Ian Hewitson. So just, Huey, just, you know, do a healthy and wealthy and wise in the kitchen with the fish. And it wasn't until, like, and that was drilled into my head for years and years. It's like that Good Friday, it's fish only, not realizing it was a religious.
Not realizing that you weren't beholden to it.
Yeah, exactly. It was just him to cook the fish. And it wasn't until a boy's holiday away and it was on the Good Friday, we're all together, and then it's like, oh, let's have some sausages. So that's it was just like a smorgasbord barbecue of steaks, sausages and everything else like that. And I'm going, you can't do that, it's Friday, it's Good Friday, you have to do fish. And they're going, you're kidding me, right? I'm like, oh god. I felt like such an idiot.
At that point, you realised that you weren't like everybody else.
Yeah, I think it was like 21, 22. So it was only roughly 20 years ago when I realised, I'm a frigging dumbass. I'm Mike Moore. That's what I was.
it was just, your Mike Moore moment.
Yeah, just a complete dimwit. Anyway, you enjoy your fish, Daniel.
Oh, there's only a couple more weeks to go as of this taping, so.
Yeah.
But surely, like, fish on a Friday is good because you can go down the chip shop and get fish and chips. That's a good thing.
And pineapple fritter.
And a pineapple fritter. I'd be getting the pineapple fritter.
Hell yeah.
And a potato cake.
Oh, scallop.
Chico roll, is that allowed?
I think there's meat in a Chico roll. I mean, there's also the dumb trap of thinking that just eating a regular pasty is vegetarian. No, there's meat in regular pasties.
Are you sure?
Well, you need to get like the vegetarian pasty.
Yeah, you have to specify that it's a vegetarian rather than the regular.
But you can eat vegetarian food on the Friday as well as the fish, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now I'm hungry.
You could get yourself a nice vegetarian pizza, maybe.
I don't know. Just usually with me, it's the Subway seafood sensation, which is
a solid choice.
So much processed meat, seafood.
Yeah, there's no meat in it there, but there may not be much fish either.
Yeah, so you're technically eating vegetarian. Hi, Kim.
Well, Alison's vegetarian too.
Yeah, I know that.
I'm vegetarian.
Yeah.
Subway does a kind of veggie patty thing, which is oddly okay. I don't mind it. But I don't know, Subway here in the UK have started doing like vegan meatballs. So that they've got a vegan meatball sub.
Huh.
I don't know if they've got that in Australia.
No, it hasn't reached us.
Never been to one.
Oh, okay.
Still haven't been to a Subway. You can smell that bread that they pump out, that bread smell. Yeah. That's very distinctive, isn't it?
Sam claims the ratings win is all about the mix of stories.
Now, last night, the lead story?
The Ebola virus down under.
We scared people, then we made them feel good.
The kid who looked after his grandmother with Alzheimer's.
Ah, then Mike interviewed the foreign minister.
Comedy.
You get the point. Good stories, good balance.
Alison?
Now, when he said he interviewed the foreign minister, comedy, he meant, of course, Gareth Evans, who is Australia's longest-serving foreign minister. And when he said comedy, I think he might mean something like this.
Your comments were widely reported.
No, they were inappropriately reported. We were at an informal drink session when I made the puppy joke, and I was quite clearly speaking, you know, off...
the record.
...off my face. I was pissed.
I assume Mike Moore grilled him about the puppy story, even though it was a couple of years old by that point.
I'm sure he would. Imagine that, Mike Moore and that Gareth Evans going head-to-head. Or just the fact that Mike Moore interviews any of those of the...
The Rob Stitch impressions?
Yeah, that'll be a great mashup.
Maybe you can do a bit of a mashup. You can do some editing.
With the 90s split screen not quite joining up effect.
I'm just wondering if Mike Moore's, I'm sure, very, very thoroughly researched and wide-ranging interview with Gareth Evans ever asked him about his relationship with Cheryl Kernow. I suspect it didn't.
He'll be distracted by the head wobbling, the constant head wobble.
The head wobble, yeah. Yes.
So in celebration for the ratings, Sam is going to shout everyone Tim Tams, except for the ones who are on air fastest. Some of the stories, the lineup, are Brooks chasing a dodgy doctor who hands out methadone just to about anyone and suggests to go in via hidden camera. Marty has a teen who has attacked his parents, as in the teen attacked his own parents, and with a carving knife, who is currently assisting police with their inquiries. It sounds an interesting one. And Brooke also has another story about sexism in the High Court.
Anything else?
Sam, my High Court story's been sitting on the shelf for 3 days now.
Oh, good. What is it again?
Sexism in the High Courts. You know, judges who say it's okay to rape prostitutes' wives.
They said that?
Well, some judge said it, but I think I can get more quotes.
From the late 19th century.
It's a good story.
It's a great story.
When have we got that penthouse pet piece?
Tomorrow.
Okay, we save the High Court story for then, all right? We'll take the Moz off. Nudity and a femo story.
The perfect mix.
Oh, Sam, what if someone beats us to it?
Oh, relax.
You know, notice, though, that Sam is completely forgetting a lot of the stories that have been approached to him.
Yeah, there's a slight hint that he wanted to spike the High Court story. Well, that's how I read it anyway.
But not just that, it's like that he intentionally forgets what Brooke or Emma has told him, because it happens again later in the episode.
When he just says, what was that again?
Yeah, and he goes, oh, you didn't tell me that. It's like, I told you last week.
Yeah, just a typical scenario of a male ignoring a female's suggestion. And
yes.
Either ignoring it or passing it off as his own later on.
Yeah, it's that other meaning of EP coming in.
Jan walks in and congratulates everyone for the ratings and praises everyone who is fasting as well as they snack, really.
And she's got just more amazing hair from Jan, by the way. She's still got the beehive, but it's a kind of curled, a sort of, I don't know, lots and lots of curls all piled up on top of each other, which is astounding. But I forgot to mention earlier that Dom is getting into the hair comedy as well. She sports several comedy hairstyles in this episode, which I remember greatly amused me and my parents when we used to watch this back in the 90s. We used to laugh at Dom's hair, so, and Jan's hair as well.
Yeah, I do remember seeing Dom in this episode wearing pigtails.
Yeah, she's got a whole bunch of pigtails sticking out the top of her head, which is it's an interesting look for her.
Hmm.
Yeah, so even in the 90s, this was considered weird. It wasn't just, you know, looking back thinking, God, that was what people were like in the 90s. That was weird for us back then.
Yeah. We laughed at it, certainly, watching at home.
Mike has a meeting with Jan, and he's struggling to get in contact again with Glenn Ridge.
Celebrity Sale of the Century. My Battle of the Current Affairs hosts idea.
Yes, I'm having a lot of trouble getting through.
Oh, so am I. Glenn hasn't returned my calls. I've got a feeling they're not passing on my message. I know. You've got Glenn Ridge's personal fax number.
Oh, I may have misplaced it.
You don't want me to do this either, do you, Jan?
Look, I think it's a wonderful idea. It's just the logistics.
I solved the logistics. It's out of your hands now, Jan. I know you've got the number, and I want you to write it down.
Are you right for that meeting with Sam? Sorry.
Coming, dear.
This is going to make them sit up and take notice. I'm going to fax it to them right now. Thank you.
Do you know how to use a fax machine, Mike?
I think I can manage it.
But speaking of fax machines, like, Jan just, you know, automatically wrote that number down, so she must know Glenn Ridge's personal fax number just out of the blue.
Her black book must be incredible, though.
Yeah.
Second only to Brooks.
Wouldn't it be her teledext?
Might be a Filofax, maybe?
Filofax, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Jan would absolutely. She'd have one of those big Filofaxes with, like, an A4 pad of paper in it.
Did I make up that word, teledext?
You mean the teletext,
that's what I'm thinking of, teletext.
But the teletext was that little, you know, the address book where you had the ABC and you kind of slide up and down.
Oh, that's what I was thinking
of,
yeah.
And that pops up.
I thought you meant telex machines, which are like the forerunner of the fax machine.
Oh, but, okay, yeah. We've got a bit of everything. We have a mix.
Everything's involved there, a lot of 80s, 90s technology all mashed up into one.
How about that? That's why, if you ever want to flashback to the 90s, listen to the Champagne Comedy Podcast.
Yeah, when was the last fax you ever sent? Anyone remember?
Early noughties, I would say.
2003.
Yeah, yeah. Early noughts, yeah.
Yeah, might have been sometime in the 2010s for me, because I was working for my father, who is a psychologist, and a lot of the communication with other medical centres and other psychologists and sort of anything medical, they still rely on faxes. I don't know if they do in present day 2024, but certainly it was still a thing in the 2010s.
Oh, yeah, they still, some of my mum's doctors still use faxes to send things to each other, but some of the faxes are done via the computer now, so you don't need an actual fax machine to do it. But, yeah, I think the last time I sent one was probably 2015, 2016, where I had to send some shipping notifications off for sending something to New Zealand. But, yeah, it was still the same process. You put it in, you had to make sure it had the little okay confirmation, just confirming that it had actually got to its destination. So maybe Mike wasn't aware, particularly, as we find out later, where his faxes are actually being sent to.
Either that or he might have put the paper in the wrong way around and basically sent a blank page.
No, he did that as well. I think he did do that, didn't he?
So now Emma finds a loose piece of paper from Shelley, which she snatches. Interesting. The plot thickens. That Shelley doesn't not get enough airtime, does she?
No, she and Jace really very rarely on screen doing anything of note.
So Sam is concerned Mike's distracted, but Jan tells him that it's because he's keen on the Sale of the Century, Battle of the Current Affairs host idea.
The Current Affairs host.
He won't give up on it.
You see the problem here, he's bored. Where is he now?
Faxing Glenn Ridge with the idea.
Jesus.
Em, it's urgent.
Hello? Yes, Mike?
No, no, the document goes face down, then you dial in the number, then you press fax.
Marty's story on the murderous teen has hit a bit of a snag. He's been refused bail, that is the teen, and that only, there's only 3 seconds of footage available. After Sam wants an interview with his parents, the ones who were murdered, oh, how awkward.
Bow.
Yeah. I like Emma's reaction. It's like, Sam? So, and Emma tries a different angle by trying to locate the video store that he rents videos from to see what type of violent movies he has rented.
It's interesting this because when I saw this bit, I was reminded of the Martin Bryant and the Port Arthur Massacre, which happened about a year later after this episode. And I remember they went down the video store and checked out what he'd rented, and it wasn't especially, you know, ridiculous from memory. But clearly this idea of checking out what people rent at the video shop predates Martin Bryant because this is 95. So there must have been other ones before that.
You know, when you do rent Police Academy 7 Mission to Moscow, it will send you...
Does that instantly make you a psychopath or something?
Yeah, well, I do have the box
set.
Well,
I've watched that film and you clearly have. Yeah. So. So far we haven't murdered anyone.
No, not yet. But it is an interesting film, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I was trying to think of a movie that had come out and before this episode of Frontline, because Mission to Moscow was 1994. Milo and Otis? No? All right. I'm clutching.
Why would you go mad after Milo and Otis, apart from maybe I can't handle these cute animals anymore?
Well, once you know Milo and Otis.
Yeah, maybe the thought of, you know, there may have been multiple animals throughout the filming, yeah. Allegedly.
Yeah.
I don't think it's ever been proven, but that's always the trope that seems to be brought up whenever I think of Milo and Otis.
And we're back to Snowtown.
Yay! There we go.
Cutting up the animals and sticking them in the bucket.
Sam is brainstorming ideas to give something for Mike to do because he's just struggling.
Now, it's got to be something that sounds important but means nothing.
There's that London Weekend television thing.
Yeah? Tell me more.
I told you about it last week.
What? I wasn't listening.
Standard reciprocal deal, straight swap. We give them our crap, they give us their crap, you know, the tacky royal stories, and we give them, say, a wacky outback piece.
Hey, getting warmer. Mm. Much work?
No, we send them a rundowns of the show each morning and they pick it off the satellite if it sounds interesting. Takes me about 5 minutes.
It'll take Mike about an hour. And he even knows how to use the fax now. Okay, right. Tell Mike he's our international story coordinator.
Oh, Sam, he's not going to buy that one.
International story coordinator.
Wow.
Yes, big job. Starts tomorrow.
All I thought of, too, with the London Weekend Television, all I thought of was, this is, I guess, my Monty Python behind me, the Rutland Weekend Television.
Yeah, well, that's what Rutland Weekend Television was. It was a parody of London Weekend Television, or LWT. But, yeah, I mean, LWT just... to give you a small amount of background, did an awful lot of comedy shows, sitcoms and sketch comedy and stuff like the Dame Edna Experience, big kind of variety shows like that. So, yeah, I mean, certainly watching a lot of British TV on Australian television in the 80s and 90s, you would see the LWT logo turn up at the end of all sorts of shows. So they're very well known.
I find it sort of kind of funny that LWT is chosen because... the way the ITV system used to work, it's sort of individual companies would run the independent independent television service in different areas. And in most places in England, they would run it 7 days a week. But in London, it would be two different companies running the one channel, one on the weekdays and one on the weekends. So technically... Mike is in charge of 2 days' worth of television per week, basically.
Yeah.
It's the most lowest effort of anything.
Yes, and I should have checked this point, but I don't know what news or current affairs shows LWT actually broadcast in that era. But, yeah, LWT would start, I think, Friday evening, and then they would go through to Sunday. And then whatever the other one who had the rest of it was – I think over the years it was Thames for a bit, and then it was Carlton and running the London franchise, and they would pick up again Monday morning and go through till sort of Friday afternoon. So, I mean, obviously, you know, in the weekdays they would have their...
The other kind of weird thing about ITV is that there was another company which would be in charge of doing the broadcasts during the breakfast TV time. So I think it was about six...
Oh, that's ITN.
That was either TVAM or GMTV. I've watched a lot of YouTube videos talking about the old ITV companies. Like, they've sort of all amalgamated and swallowed up each other, so that I think it's all the one company now, apart from like Scotland, I think. But back in 1995, there would be another company who was just in charge of 3 hours in the morning on weekdays, and it was their job to fill the schedule nationally.
Yeah, you're right about that. And actually, just thinking about it further, the news output on ITV came from ITN, which is a separate company.
Yeah.
And ITN actually has the contract not only to do the news that appears on ITV, but they also have the contract for Channel 4 news. And for a while, they had the contract to do Channel 5 news. I think Channel 5 news is now done by Sky or something. It's all terribly complex, but it does make me wonder why LWT would want current affairs output. Surely it would have been ITN who would want current affairs output. And I assume they picked LWT because people have heard of that.
Yeah.
Whereas in Australia, whereas ITN was a bit more obscure.
But yeah, it's such a weird concept. For 1995, sort of having it's like having one channel where, say, you know, Channel 7 was in charge of the output on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and you know, like, it might have been Channel 9 for the rest of the week.
So was there non-stop marathons of Dad's Army and Birds of a Feather on this channel?
They're BBC, darling. They're BBC.
Oh. See, that just shows you how much I know about that stuff. So everything UK comedy is BBC then. Sorry.
Although I'll make the point that Birds of a Feather was actually produced by an external production company for the BBC.
Oh.
Because in the 80s, the BBC started to sort of offer contracts to external companies to make programs for them, whereas up until the early 80s, the BBC had made everything in-house that they broadcast. So it's all about bringing competition into the market. And
I think some of that would have been introduced by the introduction of Channel 4 as well, because they from the outset were buying in programs from external production
Channel
companies.
Channel 4 has never made its own stuff, but why it happened at the BBC was John Burt came in as director general in the early 80s, and he was famous for axing Doctor Who and various other things. But the other famous thing he did was bring in this idea of competition. And so you would not only have separate sort of production companies providing programs for the BBC, but also really mad stuff, like they would outsource the hairdressers, you know, to a separate company, or that outsource the makeup people or the costumes or whatever. And it all became a bit mad and actually way more expensive to make television, because you've suddenly got all these little companies who have to make their profit on top, whereas you can, by insourcing everything, you can save a lot of money. So it's kind of capitalism gone a bit crazy, the history of production in British television. But that's just my leftist spin, of course.
It's nearly 8 o'clock and you're listening to BBC. No, wait, the London Weekend
BBC
Television.
One, two? which one are we on, mate? Come on.
We're on the Champagne Comedy Podcast. Yes.
I know. Where a couple of people just happen to know how British TV works.
Wow.
Well, it was very educational for me.
To the consternation of the other two.
So...
No, I found it interesting. I mean, I had no idea about all this stuff, and I lived there for 10 years as well, but this was after all.
What about on the buses and Doctor in the House, Father, Dear Father?
On the buses was ITV.
Okay.
I don't know whether it was Thames or LWT or someone else who made that. I'm not a fan of it. But LWT did a lot of stuff. Like they did the Doctor in the House series and, you know, loads of stuff.
You should see what ViVision are currently releasing, or Mad Men in Australia. They're releasing, they've gone through all the Australian archives of Channel, you know, like all the 80s and 90s dramas and stuff now. They've run out. So now they're doing all of the British comedies. So there's ones that I've never even heard of, but like one season shows with Penelope Keith, you know, or what's his name from Yes, Prime Minister. Who's the guy?
Which one? Paul Eddington?
Paul Eddington, yeah. And there's just like some really obscure ones. Hold on, I'll quickly bring it up.
Have you got it right there, or do you have to go into the next room?
It's kind of interesting, the whole DVD distribution thing, because I noticed all the BBC stuff is now transferred. Initially it was all put out by Roadshow, and then I think it moved to, I think it was Universal, Sony were distributing all the BBC stuff, and now it's transferred again to Mad Men now.
Doing a reissue of Bless This House, the complete series.
Huh.
I think that might have been LWT or Thames. No, actually, I think that was Thames.
Dad's Army, the complete collection.
Well, that's BBC. Yep. That was made in-house at the BBC, Dad's Army.
That'll look good against someone.
I don't know much about Dad's Army, but I don't think they've got everything of Dad's Army, do they? Unless...
yeah, there were... Well, the first couple series were
black and white. Wasn't there recently like an animated... a bit like some of the lost episodes of Doctor Who, they've got audio recordings of it, and they've done like an animated visuals to the audio recording. Didn't that happen recently?
They did it last year. They did it last year, and I have seen it. But yeah, basically, it's like Doctor Who. There's a bunch of episodes that got wiped, and some of the original episodes were made in black and white. So they've got some of the black and white ones, but they don't show them often because they're black and white.
Here we go. Open All Hours.
I think that's BBC.
Open All Hours is BBC, yeah.
Alcock and Gander.
No idea what that one is.
What? No, I don't know what that one is.
Oh, that's not a comedy thing. These are dramas now. A Fine Romance, complete series.
I think that was BBC, Fine Romance.
Oh, here we go. Let There Be Love. That's the one.
Never heard of that one.
Let There Be Love, the complete series. Timothy Love is a confirmed bachelor and has everything he needs at his fingertips. He is a successful businessman, has money in the bank, and a choice of girlfriends whenever he needs company. So why, when he meets Judy, should he be hearing the sound of wedding bells? Judy has three children and a dog, but there's something about her that Timothy believes he can forsake his individuality for. It's a two-disc set. So,
and he has to have the surname Love, or else they won't be able to make the title work.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, God.
Just based on the description, I can't believe they got a second series.
No, it didn't. I believe it just says the complete series, or did you just look it up?
Oh, so it's just one series, but three episodes per disc? Or is it? I'm assuming it's a six episode series, is it?
Hold on.
Or is it eight?
Two discs. The British sitcom. Oh, yeah, two seasons. There we go, 1982. Oh, it's like the Fawlty Towers thing. It's only 12 episodes.
It was so good they only made 12.
Yeah. Thames Television.
Or so
well.
Bad.
Yeah.
Oh, it's Thames. Yeah. Okay. Well, Thames has got that really lovely sort of little title logo thing.
And then straight into the bill. Scene as well.
Yes. Yeah. Well, exactly, the bill. Yeah, there we go. Was Thames, wasn't it?
Yep. All right, sorry, we've got to get back on track.
We've strayed horribly away from what we're supposed to be talking about.
Yeah, we'll just spin this off into a bonus mini episode. How about that?
Yeah, where we very badly explain British television to everyone.
Distribution system and production.
I could have got an expert on to talk about this. I have friends who really can nerd out on this topic who live here.
So that's how
you
learned about it, because you spent all these days in the pub listening to them talking about it.
Listening to them crap on about ITV regions. Yeah.
I've got to say, if you want to really nerd out, there is a series on YouTube called ITV in the Face, which talks about all of the different regions and how they all started and how they changed from one company to another company and all the rest of it.
Imagine Mitch McTaggart doing a inside thing, like just a breakdown.
Even nerdier.
His head would explode.
I'd love him to let loose on British television.
Yeah.
I think there's so much that he's uncovered about Australian television.
And isn't he just scratching the surface too?
I know. I hope he keeps going forever. It's such a great series.
Mike is talking to Jeff about his new role now, as well as his idea that he doesn't want to talk about, only unless Jeff wants Mike to talk about it.
Lovely little prodding there, yeah.
Yeah, only if you want to talk about it, though. So Brooke is prepping the patient, played by Libby Tanner, future All Saints star Libby Tanner.
Oh.
And also I think she was in A Country Practice at one stage. Anyway, so she will have the hidden camera idea to bait the doctor. Now back to Jeff's office, and Mike is expressing his bitterness over Glenn's non-response.
A thimble full of fame, Jeffrey Salter, yeah. And then it goes straight to the head.
Yeah,
bang!
Yeah, yeah. Well,
I know exactly what you mean, Mike. Oh. I mean, I see them every night. Oh. Every night, two-bit weathermen. Weathermen, mind you, not meteorologists. Guys like Monty. Monty from Good Morning Australia.
Actually, you're friends with Monty.
Oh, we talk. Well, not as much as we used to. Not since he went national. Thinks he's the cat's pyjamas.
Anyway, back to what I was talking about. What was I talking about?
The London job.
No, it was after that.
Monty?
No, before Monty.
You being on the 40-hour famine?
No, before that. Oh, Glenn Ridge.
I just like they just wrapped up everything in the episode in that one bit. The 40-hour famine, Glenn Ridge.
Monty is to Jeff what Brooke is to Mike, I guess. Kind of a slight competition.
Yeah, they always bounce off each other really well as well. So, like, the stiff competition with that. You remember, was it Monty in – he was – I think it was at Australia Zoo at one stage, and when it was a Steve Irwin thing. And the crocodile came at him and he freaked out and he had to jump up on the fence.
Oh, gosh.
Steve Irwin was going, it's okay.
Is that the one doing the rounds? Is that a meme?
No, it'll be part of a compilation or whatever, you know, 50 years of TV or whatever.
Gosh, it's too far back in the long, long list of weather persons on morning TV.
And this is when I think Liz Hayes was doing the Today Show as well. That's how long ago. Okay, fine. All right, we'll move on then.
I got nothing, Matt.
Okay,
yeah.
how about
it? I never watched breakfast television.
It was replayed on British TV. No? Yeah.
Nah.
All right.
It would have to be like on a compilation DVD with like some obscure sitcom
I think
released
it is.
By LWT in the 80s.
I think it's on the 50 Years of TV compilation.
I do have that somewhere. I can't immediately locate it. But, yeah. Oh, hang on. No, I'm struggling here.
The one that
I do have.
Everyone's losing their touch.
Yeah.
I do have Frasier Series 2, which was referenced earlier.
Hold on one sec.
Yeah. Oh, that's like a good hour before. Oh, no.
I'm gonna keep trying to find my 50 years of TV. It's got to be somewhere.
There, that.
Ah.
I don't think I have that.
Well, and this was eventually split up into the decades on five different DVDs, distributed on the Herald Sun, and then also Umbrella broke it up into separate bits as well. Anyway, 50 years of TV, the Channel 9 thing.
I'm afraid I only have Golden TV Week Logie moments, which I can see on the shelf.
I've got that, but I'm not going to go back over. That took a lot out of me.
Don't worry about it.
I'm cramped in the corner right now.
We should keep going, save that for closer to the ceremony in August.
Oh, yeah, looking forward to that.
Yes.
Cool. Brooke's doctor story goes to air with the hidden camera footage with Mike not getting the play on words with Dr. Yes.
Clearly not a James Bond fan. Disappointing.
Next day, Emma is watching the footage on the living standards of Aborigines with Colin Conacher in the background. Hooray!
Hey,
Conacher.
That's going to get a workout. Sam wants positive stories out of the whole story and managing to segue a fluff piece about Kathy Freeman into it as well. Very clever, even though she's got nothing to do with it.
Yeah, yeah. I think the quote was turning a national disgrace into a feel-good piece.
As the current affair promo goes to air about the sexism in the High Court, undercutting Frontline, Brooke wants to drop the story, but Sam wants to go head-to-head with the current affair over it. And to help promote, Brooke ends up going on 3LO to promote the story.
Well, Frontline did very well last night, Brooke.
Yes, it was a good win, Peter. Yes, we were very confident with the story.
Sexism in the High Court. Obviously, it's a big problem, because I noticed both you and Current Affair ran with the story. And a narrow ratings win for Frontline, I see. Congratulations.
Thanks, Peter.
Oh, just one final thing. Mike Moore, he's not well?
A touch of the flu.
That is the last time I cover your ass, Mike.
Anyway, Brooke, I was on a 40-hour famine. My sugar levels were low. And anyway, Dom forgot to put it in my book.
With Peter Couchman on 3LO.
Yes.
Yeah, sort of bringing the radio segments in-house, because in season one it was Neil Mitchell at 3AW, and yeah, suddenly for some reason it's the ABC station, which, again, it's kind of a weird thing considering it's a supposedly commercial station putting one of their stars on the ABC.
Yeah.
Per ABC protocol, they wouldn't be able to plug the show, really.
Daniel, what's the catchphrase?
I know. Who says we can't advertise on the ABC? Even on radio? Yeah, right.
I'm going to isolate that, and now that's going to be a new fresh grub.
Yay! I've said it too often.
Yeah. I was going
to
do it for this episode.
You should put a rap beat under it or something. Make it really zing.
I've got an idea, but if I say it now, it's going to spoil it. So tune in for the next episode. So Marty has the video rental list of the teenage killer, and the movies being Turner and Hooch. The sad part with Hooch in that movie will snap anyone into a murderous spree. You've seen Turner and Hooch, haven't you? Oh,
Brave
none night. Of you.
No.
Oh, it's heartbreaking.
Is it one of those ones where you have to go look up where the dog dies or not?
The dog dies in it.
Spoiler alert.
Nah, screw you guys. You've had
30
odd
years. Were you going to watch it anyway? Bit, I think so.
It goes a bit Charlotte's Web, does it? That's an animal reference, I understand, Charlotte's Web. that ends with an animal dying.
Tom Hanks plays a police officer, like detective or whatever, Turner, and Hooch is his sidekick, the dog that he is paired up with, and then they go through all the it's meant to be family-based, but it's quite dark, to be honest, and then Hooch sacrifices his life by being shot.
Wow.
God.
Yeah. Anyway, it's quite depressing. But hey, they spun it off into a TV series on Disney Plus.
Does the dog get shot every episode? Probably not. Probably doesn't get shot every episode.
No, that would be Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
There was also Betsy's Wedding, not Muriel's Wedding.
So rom-com, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe so. Home Alone 2. Which is a thriller. Naked Gun, which is a children's movie. Hudson Hawk, which is a musical. It
which
is actually a musical.
Load of old crap.
Yeah, only one or two scenes, though.
Yeah. Reality Bites, which is a hardcore porno.
No, it isn't.
Oh, thank you. You caught on to what I was trying to get at. And Terminator 2, which
is an action film.
Sam wants to connect Terminator 2 movie with the psychotic mind of the murderer. Meanwhile, Sam and Brooke are called up to the general manager, Bob Cavill's office, to talk about the hidden camera footage, and they are in the shit. The doctor wants a personal apology, and a personal apology he will get.
You came in here, abused my trust, wasted my time, and then held me up to public contempt without once checking your facts.
And on behalf of Frontline, I'd like to apologise for the story.
Bloody Emma, this scapegoat.
Yeah, that's the second reference where she's had to kind of make an apology. I think it was that Martin was trampled on someone's flower beds earlier on in the episode.
Are you going
to
chase it up? Yeah. Now, with that, Marty reads out the fluff piece in the paper about Mike's new role and grueling scheduler, and guess who's in the background?
Again.
Yeah.
Double-sided.
Yeah, you get quite a few references, quite a few sightings of Colin Conacher. I noticed he doesn't just specialise in Conachers. There was a Canon photocopier there, so he's,
oh, hello.
He's quite across all brands.
Maybe his name's Conacher.
Well, he's wearing a Conacher shirt.
He's wearing a shirt that says Conacher on it.
Yeah, his shirt says Conacher.
Head intrigued.
Yeah.
Wow, I did not realise that. Emma has the promo ready for the teen killer.
How's this for a promo? What sort of movies would make a man want to kill? Video violence taking over the home.
Sounds good.
That's tonight on A Current Affair.
this a joke?
I'm not finished. They're also covering the UN report and an exclusive interview with Kathy Freeman.
What?
Yeah, what indeed.
So, yeah, suddenly, yeah, Sam's calling a meeting and going, who's the mole?
But he's ready to take on ACA head-to-head regardless.
It's good, but I didn't think Terminator 2 was as good as the first.
Fine.
I liked him better as the bad.
Martin D'Stasio with that disturbing report on videos that could turn your child into a killer. Coming up after the break, our Aboriginal anguish. Yvonne Cawley speaks to us about the UN report and her life at the top.
Straight into an extra spin on that. So, same stories, different people. The next day, Sam gets a call from Bob, who's angry that he used Terminator 2 footage in a story. And Marty says, who cares, because Frontline won by 3 points. But then they find out that Terminator 2 was the Sunday night movie.
Well, what was that, 4 years after it came out? Premiere. Yeah.
That's about right for Australian television. Yeah. You have to wait years.
You're going to say that was so. It, yeah. Now, Mike is having... are you looking up anything in the program guide, Daniel?
I just thought I didn't actually look this up, but yeah, let me find the listing for the previous night and let's see what the movies are. SBS were kicking off their About Television Week. They had TV World, the broadcast tapes of Dr. Peter, Canadian documentary chronicling the journey of Dr. Peter Jepson-Young, who became one of Canada's foremost educators in the world of AIDS. And that's followed at 9:30 by reality show, a 1994 Canadian comedy, as far as I can tell, fictional. A man with a passion for watching the box becomes an instant star when he wins a competition on a television program. See, ABC, oh, okay. They had at 8:30 the Australia Remembers Gala Tribute, because remember, this was the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II was this year. So it's a concert commemorating VP Day, performed before the Governor-General, the Prime Minister, guests and veterans, live from Melbourne. Entertainers include John Farnham, James Morrison, James Blundell, Margaret Ehrlich, Don Burrows, Grace Knight and Rick Price. The Channel 7 movie was Interceptor, 1992 action-adventure starring Jürgen Prochnow, Elizabeth Moorhead and Andrew Divoff. An arms trader plots to hijack a fighter plane from a transport jet in mid-flight. When the terrorists board the transport aircraft, they encounter resistance from the crew. Directed by Michael Cohen, rated M, contains violence. I should damn well hope so with all that action. Let's see, Channel 9 had something probably not as serious as the ABC's effort, but the same sort of thing. 50 Fantastic Years Part 2, documentary which looks at how Australia has changed since the end of World War II, presented by Brian Naylor, Paul Clitheroe, Don Burke, Molly Meldrum, Tracy Curo, Denise Drysdale and Rebecca Gilling.
What a lineup.
Channel 10, again, it's all kind of serious, non-comedic kind of fare tonight. They had The Face on the Milk Carton, drama starring Sharon Lawrence, Edward Herman and Richard Masua. When a woman sees a picture on a milk carton of a girl who went missing 13 years earlier, she finds the image as a striking resemblance to herself. She searches through her family's belongings and finds a chest in the attic filled with articles that belong to an unfamiliar girl. She confronts her parents demanding the truth, but the only person who can satisfy her curiosity is unreachable.
So no Terminator 2.
Yeah, Well, I would say that Interceptor might be the closest thing to Terminator 2, but, probably not as entertaining.
Kim has actually sent me the image.
I sent you a screenshot of the I'm sure there might be a clearer picture.
You going to stick it in the chat? Oh, you're going to screen share.
Canon there.
Oh, yeah. That is such an amazing spot. Well done.
Yeah, nice find.
Adhere to just one brand, he can fix lots of different brands. Yeah.
So Mike's been doing some thinking and believes that the office mole might be Shelley, as she's been acting very strange lately and learning shorthand. Isn't that a form that's kind of a unique delicacy now, isn't it? Shorthand.
Yeah, I remember when I finished studying journalism. I was actually at uni when this came out, but shorthand was an optional thing, and I only really tried to attempt it during a correspondence course in 1998, and I think I got through about one lesson and just got a little bit bored of it, and I still have the book of it somewhere. And yeah, where I work, there's someone who knows shorthand, and he's in his 60s now, but it's, I think it kind of died out with my generation and probably all the ones after, but with, you know, recording and transcripts and the ability to just do that automatically, it's not really
dictaphones used, and micro cassettes,
AI.
And,
AI can transcribe.
The one area that it's still used in is court reporting, but apart from that, I don't think it's used much.
Now, upon checking out Shelley's desk, he finds he's gone straight for the desk, like straight away intrusive, invading privacy. He finds a notepad with the shorthand on it, and Dom reveals Shelley's applying for a sales role at Channel 9 and thought that she had to learn shorthand about it.
I thought you knew about it.
And she's learning shorthand just so she can go for a new job.
Yeah, please don't tell Sam because she'll get into real trouble and so will Kerry.
Who's Kerry?
Kerry, it's Marty's girlfriend. She's the one who told Shelley about the job.
Wait a second. Marty's girlfriend works at Channel 9. I'm picking up a new scent.
He really thinks he's Sherlock Holmes.
He's taking it too seriously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Plus, as well, Colin Conacher in the background of that too. Now, Mike probes Marty about his girlfriend, Kerry, and he discovers that they actually broke up a few weeks ago. He also probes Stu and Jace with no luck, as well as Brooke.
Hang on. Let me read between the lines. You think that I'm passing on our stories to Channel 9 in return for a job.
You're saying it.
Mike, the only person who blabs on about our stories is you.
Oh, me. Sure. I'm the mole. And who do I go and blab to?
And then it's like light bulb moment, ding. And he goes and accuses Jeff of being the mole. Poor Jeff. Oh, innocent.
Poor Jeff.
But he claims his innocence. And then you cue a montage with Elvis Costello's Watching the Detectives play.
It's a good montage, isn't it? I think the best bit, obviously, is when they get to the editor, Hugh, in his edit suite, and he very visibly tells him to fuck off. we also get Elliot, who's wearing a winged Viking hat. No one really knows why. I don't know what song he would be singing as a Viking, but, you know.
Oh, come on, in the Vikings.
Viking talk.
Oh,
in
yeah.
The Vikings.
Yeah, okay.
Is that the same hat?
Yeah.
Is that the same Viking hat from Viking talk, you know?
It probably is.
Probably. It was Bighorn's arse still in.
Yeah.
Mike also accuses Cor the cleaner. Who says it's not him. And finally, Colin Conacher, who we see a really, an amazing shot of Colin Conacher where he's wearing a shirt that has Conacher written on it, just in case we forget his name.
Yep.
And all of those people deny that they are the mole.
Now, the next day, the ratings are in, and Channel 9 have beaten them finally. And Emma is annoyed that the London weekend television people are complaining that they haven't received anything from Frontline's international story coordinator.
Yeah, I know. This is all set up for the big punchline.
Mike?
Yeah?
The Sherlock Holmes stuff has got to stop. Okay. I want your mind back on the job, okay?
Okay.
Right. Now, Em's just been given a serve from England.
Why?
They haven't even received one show rundown yet.
But I've been faxing them every day. I just finished doing this morning's.
That's not their number.
You gave it to me.
It's not my handwriting.
It's Jan's.
Jan's? But what number would I have got off Jan?
Ray, Glen Ridge.
Yes. You got Glen Garried.
Lovely, lovely cameo from Glen Ridge here. Because, obviously, very good friends with the Working Dog people, considering he's featured on The Late Show directly and indirectly.
And you know what? That concludes Frontline Season 2, Episode 4, and the Champagne Comedy Podcast, Episode 57. We made it. Yay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Plenty
a
of
nice
Christmas.
Kind of, I'd say it's a bit more lighthearted this week than it was last week. And, yeah, next episode we go back into the serious topics again. Well, fortunately or unfortunately, you can decide next episode.
So we've got a bit of light relief this episode and back to the serious stuff next time.
I wonder how much it cost them for the music rights for Elvis Costello.
Yeah, I do wonder how they have to how they have to seek permission from the artists, because some artists are very choosy about where their music is featured, and others less so.
And that could have been possibly why there was a delay for those episodes or season 2 and 3 to come out on DVD, because Frontline season 1 had come out on DVD.
Yeah.
And you can tell by the old M-rated logo.
Yeah, it was before we had the little colour-coded rectangle in the corner.
Yeah, because they came in 2003, 2004, and from there, Frontline took a while to come out, season 2 and 3, on DVD.
Hmm.
Yeah, anyway, just a thought.
Good point there.
Just a thought.
Because you don't sort of think about it too much, but... Yeah, there is a lot of commercial music that is used throughout Frontline. I mean, we didn't mention it last episode, but there was a very well-known Dreams Can Come True song that was used incidentally as well. You can ponder it all the way to the next episode.
Yeah, then you can come back with your research and spend 20 minutes talking about the distribution rights and publishing rights and, yeah.
Yeah, about music rights in television in the 90s.
Yeah, that's right.
if any of you out there have anything to contribute, how do they get in touch with us, Matt?
Well, they can reach out to us, champagnelateshow@gmail.com. And they can also check out this episode's show notes for all our socials, right? There's so many of them. After mentioning TikTok, the TikTok account, we got one extra follower with that. Thanks very much for that. Also, you can reach out to us on Facebook, search Champagne Comedy Podcast Group, as well as throwing us a dollar or buy a packet of M&M's or Tim Tams to buymeacoffee.com/TLS Champagne Pod. I just want to say as well, thank you so much for listening and being part of this podcast. And thank you, Alison, Daniel, and Kim, for coming back on. And we'll catch you next episode. My name is Matt. See you next time. Bye.
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 Thank you for listening to the Champagne Comedy Podcast, created by fans for the fans. For more information on this podcast, please visit champagnecomedy.com. Produced by Matt Fulton Productions, mattfulton.com.au.
Assholes.
Thank you for calling.